I'm John Yoder. Our theme for the five sessions, if we had a full title, if we had any reason to have a full title, would be the pursuit of the changing face of the moral problem of war. That is, to focus not timelessly or placelessly on war as a moral issue, but on comings and goings in how people understand it, especially from a Christian perspective. The quotation from Teilhard de Chardin, which serves as a general slogan, something being afoot in the universe, what Teilhard is talking about is not really primarily cosmological changes in the sense that we're going to dry up the Midwest with the greenhouse effect of our overuse of fossil fuel, but change in culture and consciousness and spirituality. And that kind of thing with regard to war is what I'll be reporting on. I am reporting more than arguing. That is, what I shall be talking about most of the time is not my own thoughts. I am, on some of these questions, an advocate. You'll find some earlier golden tapes in the library in which I argue one particular Christian perspective on the question of war. And there are things in the bookstore like that too. Here I'm rather going to be functioning as journalist or historian, that is, recounting and reporting thoughts, most of which aren't my own, or aren't only my own. Now, for the first hour, it does help to narrow our definitions of terms and to give to the concepts we use definitions that are maybe more precise than when we use them in ordinary language. That's what I mean by tools. Specific concepts that come to have a technical meaning if you want to use them to compare closely different ways of thinking. And if you do lay out on a cafeteria counter the various ways in which it is possible to think more about the phenomenon of war, there are, I think it's best to say for our purposes, four different types. If this were a university setting, I would make it more than four. If it were Sunday school, maybe we could do with three. But there are significantly different ways of reasoning. And we talk past each other very often when we use the very same words, but make different assumptions about the underlying framework or the frame of reference of the terms we're using. One possible way of looking at the phenomenon of war from a moral point of view is to say that you can't look at it from a moral point of view. This is a position whose advocates very often call it realism, and I'll say in a minute why I put it in quotation marks. That is, the phenomenon. Is it shining in somebody's face?
Or can you see on the side?
That is good as we can do with visibility. It is possible to say that the phenomenon of war arises precisely when dealing with things morally has stopped and people have decided, peoples, nations, have decided to make their relationships a matter of brute force. The early thinking about this in Western philosophical experience goes back especially to Machiavelli, who says, both with regard to a prince relating to his own people, but also one political entity relating to another, that the language of morality just doesn't apply. Or if you use it, you use it for window dressing or public relations, but really you do what you have to do. Clausewitz is the German military philosopher of century and a half ago, who said the same kind of thing. National interest is what we pursue, in peacetime with some instruments and in wartime with other instruments. It's the pursuit of politics, and politics is the pursuit of the interests of the ruling party in a given national community. You don't ask moral questions, or at least if you do ask moral questions, it isn't with the idea that you can distinguish between right, which is to be done, and wrong, which is not to be done. Hans Morgenthau was the political scientist who dominated American thinking in this matter in the time of the Second World War and just before. He said it is factually wrong to think that nations deal with each other on any other basis than interest, their own interest. There's a kind of reflex or backlash to this way of reasoning. If it is wrong to think that nations act on moral grounds, then it is, of course, right to think that nations act on grounds of interest. So Morgan does still use the language of right and wrong, and it's right to think that nations shouldn't be asked to do right. I put it in quotation marks because of the paradoxes that are built into the idea that we can continue arguing about why it is inappropriate to use moral language. To put it in quotation marks indicates also that although in any given argument someone who says, "I appeal to the way things are," realistically, believes that there is no debate about how the facts are. As a matter of fact, there are no bare facts. All facts are somehow illuminated by how we come at them, by where we stand, by what our past experience has been, and by the language we use. And likewise, if you are going to say all that we care about in this particular national enterprise is effectiveness, and if necessary, we'll use war, and if necessary, we'll use more war, it isn't as clear as you might think how you can measure what is going to be effective, what is going to work. The mechanisms aren't that mechanical. The powers of cause and effect are not that closely linked. Michael Walzer is the author of one of the best recent books in the field of thinking about war in terms of moral philosophy. He uses the word realism in quotation marks in the same way to make that same kind of point, that it isn't necessarily true that somebody who calls himself a realist is being realistic, but that's his claim. So it is possible sincerely, soberly, intelligently for decent people to say it's wrong to ask moral questions about war. Once you get into a war, you just have to win it. And you don't ask about whether it was justified, you don't ask about fighting fair. All of that is, it's not pertinent because of what war is. It is itself the suspension of the rules of a universe where you can talk about right and wrong. The second type that we look at, the sequence here isn't the only possible sequence, it's not a logical one, is what both the cultural anthropologists and the ethical thinkers call holy war. Here I could maybe put it in quotation marks too, since some of the causes wouldn't seem holy to everybody, but technically it is still that kind of language going on. If we believe that God or the gods has sent us or have sent us into a cause, we are really closest to the primitive phenomenon of war in ancient cultures. In Hebrew scriptures, we have this phenomenon which Yahweh tells the Hebrews to take over Canaan. He doesn't tell them to fight fair. He doesn't tell them to spare the innocent. He simply says that their cause is the righteous cause. And it is. They should be willing to risk everything for it. We had a Christian equivalent of the same in the Middle Ages called the Crusades. Not as simply as it's sometimes taken outside of the Muslim community, but it still is the case that Islam, from its very beginnings, has a holy war of a very similar type, and it differs from Christians and Jews in that it's still going on. The jihad is the technical term for a struggle for the absolute cause of God, for which Persian teenagers are being massacred right now because they are told that their cause is a divine cause they don't ask questions of just authority, they don't ask questions of probable success, they just go off to sacrifice, and that's the quickest way to get to heaven. There are also modern causes where something like a holy war happens. That is, the war is made transcendently valid. It's important because some revelation from above ordinary reality tells you that this is a righteous cause. Some kinds of Marxism have a kind of holy war. Some kinds of fascism have had holy war. So the holy war phenomenon is going on at any point where the claim is made that the cause is transcendent. It's above the rest of us. It's above ordinary moral relationships. And we know that because we have some revealer, whether a Moses or a Joshua revealing the will of Yahweh, or Muhammad, or the Ayatollah Khomeini, or Hitler, revealing to a particular community that what they are called to do raises their military undertaking above the ordinary level of what people fight about and sanctifies it, makes it holy. Now, in both the holy and the realistic frame of reference, one set of questions just don't come up. You don't ask about the rights or the status or the human dignity of enemy people. They just don't have any standing. You don't ask in holy war about whether you're likely to win, because martyrdom is just as good a result for the purposes of your salvation. In realism, you do ask whether you're likely to win, and Clausewitz was the first to say, if you're not likely to win, you better call it off, because there's no point, realistically, in carrying on a war which you're not likely to win. It's never possible in this frame of reference, philosophically or historically, to explain why the particular Ayatollah that you listen to is the one you ought to listen to. That is, the choice of a channel of revelation from God. That had to be made some other way. That isn't explained in terms of military strategy, and it isn't explained in terms of ecumenical relations. You just believe the prophet who tells you that this is God's will. And likewise, the Christian Crusades of the 12th century, Bernard of Clairvaux just got up and preached and said it's the will of God, and people went off to the Holy Land. As you have to believe the revealer. And obviously, you don't ask questions, if God has revealed that you should go off to war, you don't ask questions about the details of the evaluation of a particular political situation. Is it a matter of last resort? Did you give them a chance to resolve your conflict peaceably? Is the cause for which you're fighting authentically one that you have a right to fight for? Those questions just don't come up. Now, I started with the realistic and the holy types precisely because we don't usually start there. We don't usually take account of the fact that those two ways of looking at war have, in general, statistically speaking, dominated our cultural history. We have failed to see that because the other type that we'll be looking at has taken the forefront of our attention and our language and kept us from reading the history straight. But if you look back statistically, if you have a purely objective or cynical military historian tell you, most of the killing and dying that have gone on in the history of our civilization have been in wars of these two kinds, where the people on the other side did not have the status of human dignity, where the authority you were fighting for was not subject to any need to be justified. You went off because it was either a righteous cause in some transcendent sense, or because you just don't ask questions when your ruler tells you to go. There are two other modes of looking at the problem of war which make other moral claims, which do state the affirmation of the human dignity of the people on the other side of the conflict, which do ask questions about their own cause and their own means. Here too, we're talking about pure types, which get mixed up in the history and can be subdivided or can be illuminated differently, but for our present purposes, I'll limit it to these other two. What we call pacifism is one of the terms that other people use otherwise, so not assume that this covers all the uses of the term. but for the purposes of this set of four types, pacifism is the term used to describe people who say that war can never be a moral obligation. It is war meaning intentional, organized, killing of fellow humans can never be morally justified. It will still happen that there will be death in the world, but to organize for it and to do it as an explicit social program is never Christianly acceptable. That means that the pacifist will deny what people who do go to war claim. There is no cause which is superior to the sanctity of the lives of the people one would have to destroy. And there is no authority, there is no agency that has a right to dispose of other people's lives. This position, by its very nature, can't force itself on other people. You can't kill people to convince them that they shouldn't go to war. Therefore, it can't be faithfully lived out. That is, you can't run a society this way in settings where someone else is still disposed to act according to the holy war mode or the realistic mode or the one we're still coming to. And therefore, it can be faithfully lived out only when minority groups are left alone, where their neighbors have no interest in them. Nobody's attacking Iceland right now, so Iceland could afford to be pacifist. Finland can afford to be pacifist. Japan can afford not to have armies. So in particular cases where nobody's going to attack you, or in more particular cases where somebody else dominates your world and you're not in charge anyway. That is where others really dominate your society. The latter was the case, of course, for the early Christians. And it's the form of pacifism we can most easily look back to in common, although not the only one. The Jewish and Christian pacifism in the early centuries was in a setting where there was no chance that the Jews would be asked to run the Babylonian Empire in the 4th century before Christ, or that Christians would be asked to run the Roman Empire in the 2nd century after Christ. So their sweeping renunciation of violence didn't keep the empires from waging war, but it kept them out of those wars for various kinds of reasons. It wasn't only that they thought the shedding of blood was morally unacceptable. There were many other components to that vision, and we may come back to that if we want to talk more about the discussion behind the pure types. I've accentuated that it was Jewish and Christian pacifism to correct for the impression that we sometimes have that Jesus initiated something that hadn't been there before. Actually, all that Jesus did in the first century was to sharpen and clarify the kind of thing that Jews in the diaspora, that is, Jews who no longer had a nation state since the 6th century, had been thinking and believing. That is, Jews renounced the nation state in the age of Jeremiah. God told them it isn't simply that you didn't run it well enough, but statehood isn't what I want for you. You shall be scattered among the nations to represent me without having statehood, and you shall seek the peace of whatever city you land in. Jewish monotheism contributed several things that we maybe take for granted but don't usually spell out in our discussion of how we look at international politics. The Jewish prophetic world vision, when spelled out, not at the beginnings, had to say every nation has its place. If there's only one God, and this God lets Babylon be there, well then, it's not for us to destroy Babylon. All of the nations have their places, and the sovereign God of the universe, if there is only one, and if this one God is wise and benevolent, not just quirky, then the way the nations are is an all right way for them to be. We're not called to change that. So the other peoples have their dignity. Yahweh doesn't need to prove that he is the highest God. Now that wasn't always the case earlier, and in the pagan circumstances, the way you found out which God was above the other gods was that his people won their wars. And that was also the experience of the earliest Israelites. But after the prophetic generation had clarified the meaning of monotheism, they didn't really believe that God had to win wars through them to be God. If God wants us protected, he can protect us without our fighting for ourselves. And there are stories like that in the Jewish canon. And maybe if we are being attacked by somebody, God wants us to be punished. So we shouldn't refuse the punishment by fighting back. So generally the Jewish world vision made sense out of the renunciation of war well before Jesus came along. All that Jesus did was to reinforce that. He reinforced it as a teacher in the kind of thing we have in the Sermon on the Mount about the fulfilling of the law and about his disciples resembling the Father. That isn't said on any other moral subject. It isn't said very generously in the New Testament, but Jesus does say at the end of chapter 5 of Matthew's Gospel that if you love your enemies, you're like God, because God is also without discrimination with regard to whether the people he loves are good or evil. So Jesus, as teacher, does sharpen, clarify the reasons for the dignity of the enemy, but it isn't a brand new position. Jesus contributes as well to this discussion, obviously, by his own way of responding to the role of liberator that he was called to. This is something that I deal with in a book that's now 16 years old called The Politics of Jesus, which some people at Holden have already read. But, which isn't my case, isn't my argument for now. But when Jesus faced the task of being a national liberator, which was his calling, that's what the angel told his mother he would do, he did it nonviolently. He did it in a way that did not set aside at all the agenda of liberation, but he did it by creating a people who would follow him bearing the cross, rather than by making the Romans be the victims of his righteousness. So there were resources for the early Christians. Their pacifism made sense, I'm just saying. But obviously one thing that it didn't occur to them to do was to make the Roman Empire be a peaceable kingdom. That wasn't accessible. Christians come into a new situation in the 4th century, the age of the Emperor Constantine, who, instead of persecuting Christians, decides to make an alliance with them. They are still not by any means a majority, but they are a privileged minority. And to be a privileged minority, they suddenly discover that they can't make their nonviolent ethic reach to be what they're now trying to be in the new imperial situation. I can break down the logic of this shift with just some code words. Although Christians are a minority, they want now to be the religion of everybody. So they have to make the lifestyle they talk about understandable to everybody. It can't be heroic anymore. They can't ask too much of people. You must now have an ethic for every man. Well, turning the other cheek and loving your enemy and bearing the cross are an ethic of heroism, not of ordinary people. So in order to keep from being too demanding, not to ask too much of the common man, the ethical vision from before had to be somewhat moderated and diluted. A second reason for the same kind of change, these four slogans are not four different changes, but four angles on the same change. If you now are in a position of social control, you begin to care about the consequences of everybody's action. When you're in a minority, you don't act on the basis of what will happen if we do this and what will happen if we do that, because what we choose to do as a tiny minority, whether Jews or Christians in the second century, makes no difference for the outcome of anything that matters. But now that we're going to be an elite group of people, we do calculate consequences. In calculating consequences, you begin to come up with some reasons for your use of violence for good causes. You can say that also not so much in terms of outcomes, but in terms of the logic or the assumptions. Immanuel Kant, much later, got the credit for stating something that's a general axiom of our culture. When I want to know whether I should, what I should do, when I want to test a possible thing to do, I ask, what if everybody did it? That's partly a question about consequences too, but it's more than that. It's a question about the frame of reference in which we act. We test what we might do by asking, what if everybody were to do it? And that's such a reasonable thing to say that it doesn't occur to us in our culture not to think otherwise, until somebody with some anthropological perspective comes along and says, wait, that assumes that you're the minority. Minority people never think that way. Jews in the Soviet Union, Baptists in the Soviet Union, never measure their social ethics by what would happen if Gorbachev would do it, or if everybody would do it. That measurement is itself an establishment way of thinking. But it is the way that we have been taught to think in the last 16 centuries in the West. And then, of course, it's not only that everybody will do it, and not only we care about the consequences when we do it, and not only that we want an ethic for the common man who doesn't have a lot of commitment to Christian heroism, but Caesar himself is one of us. The man who matters the most in world history is now on the side of the Christians. Actually, Constantine himself was not baptized until near his deathbed, but after that, Caesars were mostly baptized. So he's one of us. And obviously, you don't want to have an ethic that your most prominent member can't live up to. So you better change your ethics so that your most prominent member can do what you say is right. As a result, they're developed, and this is obviously being said a little schematically, but they're developed a whole new network of angles on the war question. And when this network is taken together, a system of many considerations, it's called the justifiable war tradition, or sometimes more briefly, it is another way of thinking about war. I say justifiable, often in simple code language people say just, but it isn't meant that war is a righteous thing to do and not a good thing to do. It's still an evil, but it's an evil which may be necessary. It is justifiable. You can make a case for it. It's not obligatory either. That is something that meets the requirements of a just war, as we'll be describing how these requirements get spelled out, might still not be a moral obligation. The invasion of Hungary by the United States in 1956 would have been, according to some theories and according to the propaganda positions taken by John Foster Dulles, would have been a justified war. But we didn't do it. The concept of a justified war is not that you have to, but that if you do, it's all right. You can make a case for it. This system says that war is not always wrong, as the pacifist had said, and it's not automatically right, as the first two positions had said, on the grounds of one of them simply letting the ruler decide and the other letting the Ayatollah decide, but rather you've got to look at cases. There must be careful attention to specific cases. Most wars are questionable, and some may meet the questions and prove that they're justified by measuring up to a series of criteria. Those that meet these criteria are justified, and those that don't aren't. So it's a position which discriminates. It says neither easily yes nor easily no, but asks to look at the case. There are causes which may justify a war. Defense, reparation, the restoration of peace, the saving of peace. There are legitimate authorities who may properly wage a war. A bandit can't, private citizen can't, but a real king can. And then you have to discuss what constitutes an authentic authority. In the Middle Ages, when this system developed, there was not much problem. If your daddy was a king, you're a king. And that's what it takes, that is legitimacy. In later years, then, of course, more questions get raised about what it means to be legitimate government. And some people who inherited the throne are using it badly, and people start saying they don't merit being on the throne, and you have the phenomenon of rebellion. It makes it more complicated. We'll come to that. There are conditions under which a just authority may fight a war for a just cause. It must be a matter of last resort. In modern times, it should take account of provisions of treaties and international laws. There shall be due process, such as prior negotiation, a declaration of war, and there should be probable success. Because if you start a war that you're not going to win anyway, the result is certainly more evil than if you had given in the first place. Because you add to the evil that the enemy was going to do, the evil that you do in vain to try to stop him, and the evil that he does in addition to overcome your resistance. So the whole world is worse off than if you hadn't fought in the first place. This criterion of probable success is the one that is distinct from the holy war, of course, where you don't ask the question of probability, partly because you trust in miracles, and partly because martyrdom is also glorious. This total package of several criteria, and I didn't name them and label them with precise numbers because in the sources they're quite different, it's the justifiable war system. Where does it come from? Well, obviously it had to put together by Christian thinkers after Constantine. Its intellectual history is one of borrowings. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, political administrator before he was converted to Christianity and made a bishop, borrowed from the Roman political philosopher Cicero some of the earliest statements of how you get the rules for how a person in political office ought to operate by looking at the nature of the political system. So it's due process, it's the way things are. Then that was filled in with reference to the biblical story, looking back to the wars of the Bible. Of course, historically speaking, they were not just wars in this sense. They were holy wars, if we use our typology. But Ambrose and Augustine in the 4th and 5th centuries didn't have our typology yet. But they knew that war couldn't be wrong if some of them had been all right in the Old Testament. That was then reinforced in the later Middle Ages by the developments from canon law, that is, the rules about the purity of religious ritual. If you are to function as a priest, you must not have shed blood, even in a just cause, because there's something about the ritual purity of the priestly role that is polluted by having that involvement in death and in hostility, a ritual worldview on morality rather than a social ethics one. And later it was reinforced by other sources, like the special code of chivalry. That is, a knight is someone who has the special vocation of fighting for just causes and of fighting very fairly. A knight will only kill other knights. He will not kill women and children and peasants. He will fight according to the rules. He would rather lose than win by fighting, by breaking the rules, because there is a nobility about his vocation. Those elements of restraint were drawn into the just war tradition, so that by the late Middle Ages, there was a pretty well-organized set of ideas about what may make it legitimate to have a war. Now, each of these criteria is itself debatable. If you say the authority must be legitimate, then you ask how you know that a given prince is legitimately the prince in his nation, and how his nation really owns a particular piece of turf. So there is a commonsensical quality about this way of reasoning. Each of the definitions of terms sends you back to some other term that you must have defined before you can carry on a conversation. The big one in modern times is proportionality. The war must not do more harm than the harm it seeks to prevent. And you say that also about a particular weapon or about a particular strategy. It must not be disproportionate. But how do you measure proportion? If you measure lives against lives, well, then you can count at least. If you measure lives of soldiers against lives of civilians, there's already something skewed because the soldier has committed himself to jeopardize his life and the civilians should not be in danger. But then when you remember that many wars in modern times are fought for causes like freedom, how many freedom is worth how many lives? How do you do that measure? If you are fighting according to the rules in a civilized country, and you respect the rules which say that you must not destroy monasteries and museums, it will take you more lives to seize a city than if you didn't respect the museum and the cathedral. Well, how many lives are a cathedral and a museum worth? All of that is proportionately calculated. You can only reason this way if you claim you can do that. But how can you do that? How can you reduce the various kinds of values that are at stake to common denominators so that you can weigh them against each other? But the system assumes you can do that. So that means that for our purposes, we have to take seriously its claim to be able to do that, to make proportionality changes, measurements, and let those measurements determine what strategies you're going to use. Now, we'll be seeing then through the rest of the week the way change happens. It happens pretty largely in the changing of the weight that these four ways of thinking can have in our society. I think for this time, I shouldn't enter into that narrative because it'll make more sense to keep it in a row, but at least look ahead to saying that is what's going to happen. There are times in history, especially our history of the West, when the holy or the realistic mode dominates so much that nobody's asking moral questions about war. There are other times when social changes, cultural developments make it possible or even make it imperative or even make it unavoidable that some people start asking the justifiable war questions of particular wars, and that's especially the case in this century in ways that I'll be reporting on, especially in the third hour. The pacifist undercurrent in Western culture has never been completely forgotten, has never been very important, although in modern times it has sometimes become strengthened because it coincided with the justifiable war position in condemning certain particular wars. And the pacifist who says no war is acceptable and the just war person who says that some war is not acceptable can make common cause in that particular setting. And there have been different resurgences of the pacifist position in Western history as well, some kind coming out of that kind of common cause with the just war people, and more often coming from new movements of religious renewal. So the tools that will help us sort out the story and will help us in our own conversation if we want to debate about the various positions that we have held or see people holding, I think, will be these four concepts. They're categorically different ways of reasoning. They talk past each other, they use the same words, they make the same measurements, they justify the same weapons under certain circumstances, but with very different understandings of what's going on, and very different capacities to dialogue. The just war position, in principle, ought to be able to dialogue. As we say, we have to fight you because you have done this wrong thing. If you would negotiate, we wouldn't have to fight at all, and we'll use these weapons which are within the rules, and this is what it will mean. You can surrender and you can have peace by accepting our conditions. It's a very, ideally, it's a very manageable way of carrying on political conflict. Whereas
the first two aren't manageable at all and don't intend to be, because the people on the other side have no human dignity. The pacifist angle is different precisely because it doesn't let its decisions about what to do depend on whether it'll work or not, but gathers its guidance, gets its guidance from some other criteria, whether in the specific Christian or Jewish case, something about the nature of God and God's will, or in modern times from other sources. I suggest now that for the last 15 minutes we just let your thoughts mill around in any direction on the level of concepts, rather than entering into the details of the history of what happened later, especially up what led up to recent developments. Although if it would help, you can also reach ahead and anticipate a little of the reporting the rest of the week, if that would anchor these abstractions for you better.
How would you classify our involvement in Central America and Nicaragua? The war necessarily down there has different motives, but our involvement and our fueling of that, which one of those would you put that under?
Well, the official rhetoric of the United States would clearly be just war. Mm-hmm. Somebody has created an offense, has destabilized the area, has attacked their neighbors, and we are coming to the defense of the neighbors they threaten, and we are supporting their own citizens who were mistreated. So the official government interpretation of what the United States does, supporting the other regimes against their insurgents and supporting the Contras in Nicaragua, is said in just war language. And that's a good specimen of the difficulty of using it, because almost every one of the terms that you use to make the case for a war in just war terms, somebody else would come and say, but that isn't true, because the government in Managua is more legitimate than that, or the Contras are not that legitimate, or the government in Honduras is not that legitimate. So the questions you have to ask to discuss the just war position, to apply to particular cases, always involve you in debatable readings about the facts. Very difficult debatable readings about the facts, but that's what this system calls for, because it wants to be based on the facts. It doesn't want to be based on this moral revelation. That's its claim, its virtue, is that it's based on the facts. The pacifist never has to think to know whether to kill people. He just knows it's wrong. A holy warrior doesn't have to think. He just asks what the Ayatollah told him to do tomorrow. The realist doesn't have to think. He just asks what his prince told him. But the just war person has to think all the time about cases. And that means you're always debating the facts of the situation. And those facts are, if it's worth killing people for, always very debatable. But that's the nature of the moral discourse that these people, that the just war tradition calls for.
Yes, but you can say that you are for justifiable war when, in fact, you don't want any questions. You just want to justify and have no questions, as if you were the Ayatollah.
Yeah, if we second guess the psychology of the people who use just war language, they may be using it to cover a holy war reality or crusading reality. In fact, pacifists think that's the case most of the time. But to be ecumenical, we try to take people at face value first.
Because the war in Central America, from our involvement, is also to rid the world of communism and Marxism.
Well, if you say it that way, it gets more clear that it is crusade-like. When, if you state transcendent causes and not just what ought to be the shape of a just peace in this particular land, but you make a world overarching cause, like making the world safe for democracy, or defending the free world, then you're moving clearly to the holy kind of level, where you can't conceive of what the objective frame of reference would be that would tell you you shouldn't do it, or what would be the ecumenical frame of reference from which you would get guidance that would tell you it's a wrong undertaking.
Any question?
No.
Civil War seems to have had at least a couple of these operating on a kind of a major level of Christian. I was wondering what your reaction would be, or how you would put the American Civil War. I see the just war here, perhaps from the standpoint of Abraham Lincoln's position, and the holy war theory from the standpoint both of some elements in the South and the North, and it certainly took on an enormous energy on the part of both North and South to participate in it, and they seemed to give themselves to it on almost like a holy cause. I'm just trying to, I guess, understand these mm-hmm. lines of history. Is it sometimes the case where you end up really having two of these operating in a very legitimate way at the same time by different sectors of the society?
Well, these are intellectual ideal types, so nobody's cheating in real life. Sometimes one kind of argument is used and sometimes another. There's something a little more complex, particularly in Abraham Lincoln. As I said, if we were trying to do something for university credit, we'd have more cases here. There is something else that's not quite the Holy War and not quite the Just War that reaches back in cultural anthropology to the idea of the duel or the ordeal, in which there is a struggle and the gods will determine through this struggle who was on the right. It's found in ancient cultures in many places. And Abraham Lincoln actually said that in his second inaugural. We can't even say who's right. We just have to fight to the end, and God will decide who's right. Now, obviously, he wouldn't have been carrying on the battle the way he did if he wasn't pretty sure that the Union side was the right side. But he had a kind of piety behind that self-righteousness, standing in judgment on the self-righteousness of the American cause. Maybe we aren't right, and we have to recognize a sovereign God who maybe will tell us we were wrong, and the way he'll have to do it is to defeat us. So there's more theological depth in what Lincoln was doing. But the war itself, he was still fighting for the Union according to the Constitution, and for the Union to make people stay in the Union that promised to stay in the Union and started shooting at us. Still a just war in the ordinary sense. So in the day-by-day prosecution, it was probably just war on both sides and how they made the case for what they were doing. But in Lincoln's piety, there was something deeper than that. And I suspect in some of the self-righteousness of both sides, once you get going, it, one tends more and more to think God must be on our side and the other people must be subhuman, must be not worthy of being treated as fellow human beings. Now, one of the places this gets tested in modern times is that if you claim to be fighting according to the just war discipline, and in modern times, that means also the international treaties and rules with regard to the treatment of prisoners. And it very often will show in the carrying on of a war that we refuse to apply those rules to our enemies because they're not worthy enemies. The Southern forces said, for instance, that if we catch a black Union soldier, we won't deal with him as a soldier, we'll deal with him as a runaway slave. Doesn't merit being dealt with as a Union soldier. So the just war discipline is one of, we only play with the rule according to the rules of people who play according to the rules. We can accuse people on the other side of not playing according to the rules, and we don't have to play by the rules either with that. So you dehumanize the enemy on the grounds of something about the cause, and then we slip out of the just war discipline.
Any comments about a war which is really in fact not a war, but let's say the drug war, which is a universal industrial nations of the world banding together to fight something which is spread out all over. Does that fit any category in there, or does it have any remnants of?
I think there are reflexes. That is, a cultural anthropologist would say the same reflexes are working. Political scientists would say it's a very different set of things, because what constitutes a crime, what constitutes a war, is different. But the idea that by raising the threats, you can get the people on the other side to quiet down, we decree a death penalty for certain kinds of drug dealing, and we think that'll make it stop. The notion that you can use an army on this kind of thing instead of what it would take really to interdict communications and shipping, I think there is some deep reflex that says when people on the other side are bad, then we will start being bad in return, but we'll do it according to certain rules. We'll have certain regulations, and we'll pass laws first. We won't just strike out. We won't shoot everybody. But we may act disproportionately as long as we know that the people on the other side are the bad guys. But if the people on the other side have forfeited their human rights, their rights to due process of law, for instance, they may be summarily executed. Then you're moving up to the holy kind of thing. The infidel on the other side doesn't have rights. And I think we tend to do that in our language, public language about the drug threat.
My understanding of the situation in El Salvador and perhaps in the early stages of Vietnam was that it's termed a low-intensity conflict, which I guess just means that they terrorize the population and destabilize the country without declaring war. How does that kind of situation fit into these categories, or does it?
Yeah, well, the way it's supposed to fit, according to theory, if I want to respect the theory and put it in the best light, is that that's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. There is to be a declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
And the War Powers Act, after the trouble in Vietnam, clarified under what conditions a president may have the right to do a little bit of something, but not too much, before he has to come back to Congress. All of that is trying to put teeth in the just war tradition and say, you don't involve us in escalating violence against peoples without it being checked out for its legitimacy. Obviously, the short-range interest of any military administration is not to have to do that accounting to the legislature until you're in a position where you can make a pretty good case for what you're doing. But the tradition would say you have to have an accountable way of getting into this hostility. You can't just gradually escalate from saying that you're sending a few advisors to the South Vietnamese government without there being a point at which you have to say, do you meet the requirements for justifying war or not? Of course, that was one of the big parts of the drama of Vietnam. The other parts we'll see the next time when we come to that. There were many ways in which the development of resistance to Vietnam was expressed by people in just war terms. Because they weren't pacifists who said nothing should happen like this, but they were just war good American citizens who said we can't justify this and this and this and this according to the rules of fighting clean. Low intensity is one of the ways in which both sides try to obtain their political objectives without triggering the whole mechanism of war.
They still kill people. So, I mean,
not only do they still kill people, they tend more to kill innocent people.
Yeah. The civilians are targeted.
Because there are, but of course that's their fault, that's not our fault, the theory says. I heard this explained by a British Marine captain who was involved in the successful low-intensity work of the British in Malaysia 20 years ago, and is now involved in the unsuccessful work in Belfast. If the other side would stand up and fight fair, then we'd fight with them and we'd win because we have the guns. So the fact that they don't, that they fight from behind the bushes and don't wear uniforms, that's the offense of the other party. Now we have to meet them on their turf. So the blame for the low intensity conflict is ascribed to the other side. Well, these are good specimens of just getting the vocabulary in mind and seeing that each of these ways of thinking is consistent, coherent. You can be a whole person, an intelligent person, and think any one of those four ways. And it gets more complicated if you mix the different ways because they are different kinds of reasoning. And then what we'll see for the next two times is the coming and going of the just war mode. as deep background and then more recent background in our own cultural discussion of these matters.
In our own American Revolution, would that be a holy war?
No, I don't think many people in the American Revolution called it holy. I guess the famous story of Pastor Muhlenberg taking off his robe and having a uniform underneath maybe would have come close to that. But I think that was rather, if it was justified, and for those for whom it was justified, that was a justifiable revolution, which is a subcase of a just war. That is, there is an offense. It can't be resolved any other way. You do have a legitimate authority to do it, namely the colonial governments, which have cut off their ties with London. So it was possible to argue that it was a justifiable revolutionary war.
Where I was coming from was the original concept was that they came here so they could worship as they wished. And I thought that would bring it under.
That led to the creation of the colonies in the first place, but that isn't what they were defending.
That's right.
Because King George would let them worship as they wished. He just wanted tax and some other political stuff from them.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of a war that was holy, that would be considered a holy war that they also did not justify?
You mean that is purely revealed and you don't have to give political reasons?
Yeah, or what an example of an instance of a war where the people considered it a holy war but never questioned whether it was justifiable or not. I mean, it seems to me that any time you make a case for it's a holy war, you have, in essence, justified your actions.
Yeah, you would, but it's a different kind of justification. It isn't justified on the basis of last resort or probable success or whether your king is the king of the territory you're fighting for. It's when Bernard of Clairvaux sent the Christians off to the Holy Land. Nobody claimed that the Holy Land belonged to the King of France, but they're going over there anyway. Nobody claimed that it was last resort. It's just that God had revealed we're going to go over and take the Holy Land. Or when Khomeini sends teenagers over to die in Iraq, he doesn't set up a theory about how much of that land really belongs to Iran. He's just fighting the devil. And that's what he tells the kids. So the extreme cases of holy war, I think, we do find some where people they feel dispensed from the need to go through the nuts and bolts of the political justification. In other cases, there would be a lot of overlap, yeah. When in both world wars, sizable numbers of British and American preachers said that the war against Germany was a crusade. They used that language somewhere. But they still would have given political reasons about last resort and the bombing of the torpedoing of submarines and the other kinds of things that justify getting into it. So there is often overlap. Thank you.